Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to this talk about farm-based education and food system transformation. I'll start off with a little bit of background about myself, Michelle Gilman, and I work as an environmental nutrition consultant on a few different projects locally in Massachusetts, where I live, as well as on the national platform of Regain, and some international work as well. And so you can learn more. My website is foodfluency.org. And I got into this work really through community nutrition. I started doing that in 2016. And that's what kind of sparked my whole interest in food as medicine and food as the connector of so many of our human public health issues and just really like planetary emergencies and social issues. And so from then I went on to study global nutrition more and learned about the wider role of diet in regenerative movements such as regenerative agriculture and lifestyles, which has led me to now working as a network weaver with Regain. And so this is a part of that effort to get the conversations going around different areas within regenerative agriculture and how we're sparking the sharing of resources and knowledge on this platform to support everybody doing this really ambitious work. And so I'm really pleased to have Shelby here, who she'll tell you, where she's joining us from and what led her to this exciting research. But essentially, she's in the process of putting together a thesis study to explore farmers' and educators' perspectives on educational programs that they offer on farms, and essentially finding out how farm-based education program for youth and young adults are balancing both farming and educational activities, and the ways that these are and are not supporting sustainable and equitable food system transformations. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what led you to this work and this area of study, Shelby.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for the great introduction. That was well said. So basically, I'm calling in right now from Bouf in the Ardèche region of France, where I'm living. And I'm at the final portion of a master's in agroecology degree that I'm getting in conjunction with two universities, one in Norway, the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, just outside of Oslo. So I lived there for the year before this one, 2021 to 2022. That's it. That's how time works.
Sounds right.
Yeah, thank you. And then the second year of the program has been here in France. So I was in Lyon, France. That's the southwest of France, kind of pretty close to the Alps and along the Rhone River. And I was there for a semester, and then now I'm writing my master's thesis. And I was our program works where you're able to choose whatever topic you want within agroecology and do it. So yeah, so I'm, as Michelle said, I'm writing my thesis on farm-based education. And basically what led me to that topic is was really before the master's degree even started for me. I was working for about 5-6 years in the field of outdoor education under a lot of different within a lot of roles. I did a lot of trail work where I was working with teenagers building and constructing trails, where the kids would, I'd have crews of 6 to 8 teenagers, and we would camp out and form kind of mini like intentional communities basically for 5-6 weeks and do some really wonderful like service-based learning. So while I was doing that, I was also farming on the side, like just woofing, which is the worldwide organic organization of farms, I think, is what that stands for. Woof, if you're not familiar. I imagine most people on Regain are familiar with woof, but So I was doing a lot of that, and I really after about 5-6 years of various outdoor education jobs, including also wilderness therapy and just being a straight backpacking instructor as well, I really kind of was craving merging the two worlds of this sort of like immersive outdoor education environment with farming. Because I was sort of getting to the point where farming felt like a more maybe productive and healthy way to channel my like care for the environment and environmentalism than maybe trail work did, where trails, we were sort of building, I mean, lovely ways to access nature. Like you can recreate on the trail and enjoy it, but it felt like kind of a separate human versus environment sort of a relationship, where like we're just visitors accessing the space. And really in my farm work, I felt like I was finally sort of connecting to nature and part of it a lot more. And like a bit more of a symbiotic relationship, where I'm giving something to land and receiving something back, which I would imagine resonates with regenerative agriculture, since that's kind of a basis of it. So anyways, that brought me to kind of think to enter this master's program really like already with a bit of a goal of learning more about the pedagogy side of things, the education side of things. And and basically like with this sort of background goal of wanting to work within farm-based education after. So that's where the thesis idea came from.
Okay,
long nutshell.
But it paints us a really nice introduction of what led up to that, because there were some things there that I hadn't heard from you yet before, and it's cool that you were doing these two different worlds and you wanted to bring them together. I think that's an awesome way to carve a very unique and impactful path in your career. So I remember hearing that in your research, you've come up with these three themes of analysis, which were agroecology, popular education, and food justice / sovereignty. So I'm sure they all interact in very dynamic ways and can't really keep them separate from each other, but that for the, you know, point of analysis and research, it is helpful to have those three categories. So we'll probably mostly focus on the agroecology component here, but I'm curious to hear from you just a brief explanation of each of the three themes and how they kind of weave together.
Sure. So before we talk about the three themes that ended up sort of emerging as like my major themes of analysis that Michelle just mentioned, I'll just go over a little bit like how the research has gone and what it's based off of. So first off, this all started, the thesis project started back in the fall when I was in Lyon, and I dove into a literature review, so looking at lots and lots of published research on agroecology education and farm-based education in general. And specifically, I was interested in looking at education that was actually connecting to food system transformations, and found some really interesting research on that. So that kind of directed the thesis project in general. So for the critical food systems education theory, which was from two researchers who were looking at the question of how can food systems education actually prepare individuals and educators to transform food systems and help communities attain food sovereignty. So that was a question I was certainly really interested in. And the authors of this paper came up with the four concepts: agroecology, food justice, food sovereignty, and popular education. I decided to merge food justice and food sovereignty for the sake of my research project. So agroecology, there's a lot of definitions out there It can be looked at as a science, a movement, or a set of agriculture practices. I actually took it for my project to mean to more be the set of agriculture practices. So yeah, I used a definition of a set of agriculture practices which seek to improve agricultural systems by harnessing natural processes, which again is, you know, something that should be pretty familiar sounding to regenerative agriculture folks and is quite in line with regenerative agriculture principles. Yeah, and with agroecology, there's a lot of focus on like different scales. So you can look at practices within just the field scale. So we're looking, you know, that's something like whether a farm is including companion cropping or is choosing to use drip irrigation or something like this. So it's really, you know, specific practices or, you know, small scale practices. You can look at entire farming, the entire farm scale. So that would be something like how farmers are choosing to rotate their crops or graze their animals or something like that. And then you can actually zoom out agroecology to the entire food system scale. So that's where we're you know, sort of not just looking at like the farm as a closed system. It's actually connected to where does the food go after? How is it transformed or processed? Who's getting to eat it? Where are things coming into the farm? Like, for example, is the farm importing compost or importing soy feed or whatever it is? So it's trying to really zoom out and get more of like a holistic picture of the whole food system. So that's agroecology in a nutshell. For food justice, I just went with a kind of simplistic definition of looking at the structural, racial, and class-based inequalities in the food system. And then so for food sovereignty, I chose to use Levia Campesina's definition, since in many respects they could be sort of coined as the movement that put words to food sovereignty, starting back in the 1960s and 70s in Latin America. They define food sovereignty as the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their right to define their own food and agriculture systems. And we're gonna, with all of these concepts, talk about ways that we're actually seeing these things in practice. So for now, it's kind of, it might sound a bit abstract and lofty. And then lastly, is popular education. So popular education is sometimes also called critical pedagogy. And it's really stemming from quite specifically a Brazilian author, Paulo Freire, who wrote Pedagogy of the Oppressed in 1972. And it's really, challenging the narrative that education has to reproduce dominant societal structures and norms. And it's trying to encourage students to reflect and evaluate the dominant paradigms that they're sort of subject to, and actually turn education and schools into quote unquote forces for liberation. So it's a very peasant-based peasant-based and farming-based education school of thought. So those are the like large sort of abstract concepts that I basically have been going back on all the people I interviewed. So I interviewed in depth 14 different organizations, 13 in the US and one here in France that I'm actually living at. So I'm doing action research at. And I've been going through all of these interviews and doing text-based analysis as well for what these programs have, some of the materials they have online, and looking at how I'm seeing these concepts sort of play out in real life.
And I remember, like, when I attended the your first webinar and learning about popular education, it was really nice to have that kind of like label, you know, for lack of a better word, like label or just like historical context to apply to such a concept that's so important for my work and the work that mm-hmm. I'm trying to do with more of like community education and using education as a tool for enabling people to have a better relationship with their food and how far that can go to kind of rethink this traditional teacher-student structure to where it's like with foods everybody's been eating their whole life, right? So we're not coming in and teaching people like things that they already know about food or assuming that they don't know anything, but more of like collaborative teaching. And so many times when I was leading cooking workshops, I learned from people little tips and tricks that they had with food and staying healthy. So yeah, everybody's a teacher, everybody's a student. And I think that's a really nice educational, like, or nice historical context. Like I want to go back and look more into Paulo Freire's work. So I guess it'd be really helpful for people that are totally new to a lot of this, like, what is farm-based education? What does it tend to consist of? What are some common learning objectives? Kind of paint that picture of a typical day.
Yeah, maybe something to we can even a bit like add context, because really the thesis really started as more of a very exploratory, like, exactly what is farm-based education, like what programs are out there and what are they doing, what do they look like, and then as I kind of went along, it sort of has narrowed into, you know, I had to eventually actually have research questions. So it's narrowed into a, you know, how are those programs connecting to food system transformations? And then also, how are they balancing pedagogy and production? Yeah. So when this when the project started, I really just wanted to get a sense of what farm-based education actually is and what it's looking like out in the real world. So I mentioned before, I did this literature review where I came across a few theories that were really interesting in terms of connecting education to actual food system transformation. But those were just theories, and a lot of that work was actually based on really explicitly movement-based education programs from Latin America. A few different programs in Brazil, such as the Landless Workers Movement, La Via Campesina, which is across all of Latin America, really. Campo a Campo is also from Brazil. But anyway, so I was curious how this is looking, you know, first of all, in the US, since that's where I'm from and where I had access to, you know, actually being able to interview people, and then France as well, since that's where I'm living now. And then I also was curious what it looked like if I just was looking at farm-based education, because these theories aren't necessarily, they're more looking at, agroecology education, like it's not quite necessarily like education at a farm. And that was, that's a sort of a realm that's not necessarily that studied in academia yet. But it's something that interested me because I, like I said before, I was really going into this master's interested in merging the worlds of outdoor education and farming. So farm-based education. So I kind of began after that literature review with when I was actually starting to write the thesis and come up with research questions and do the background research. The first phase was really very exploratory of what actually is farm-based education. What does it look like? Where our program, where are programs that are doing it? What are they teaching? It was like very kind of a, you know, spread of what is going on in this world. So there were a few things I did when I was first starting the project. I first of all, went around to, I was at home in the Bay Area for January and February to do the, you know, you could say field work of the project. And I went to farmers markets all across the Bay Area in California, and just interviewed everyone, basically. Like, just would walk up to farmers at the stands and just ask if they had education programs, if that was something they were interested in, if they would want to have education programs. I got an overwhelmingly large response of course, I don't have education programs. I'm a farmer at a farmer's market. I don't have time for that. So yeah, I think here I can pull it up actually. Yeah, 85% of the farmers I interviewed in this sort of just random, randomly asking people at farmers markets, 85% said, no, I do not offer education programs. Most of them giving time as the main reason for why they wouldn't. And then second to time was staffing. So yeah, I heard a lot of, like, for example, this was a literal quote from someone: I'm too busy. When you can't manage your farm, you can't offer education. Or another quote: we're focused on production. Of course, we can't have education at our farm.
Can I ask a quick question, actually?
Yeah.
When you went up and asked them, like, did most people that you asked at these farmers markets out of the blue, like, know what you meant when you said education program? Or did elaborate more?
Totally. And that actually, like, is part of, in general, like, this kind of helps, it helps really try to define what is farm-based education, which was hard to define. So yeah, a lot of people would ask, what does that mean? What are you really talking about here? So I kind of, especially for this part, I left it very broad of are you hosting programs, like actual programs where people are coming and like taking a course or taking a class? Are you maybe opening your farm to a school coming and they do the pedagogy, but you're offering your land? And then I even was like, just simply, are you doing farm tours or activities or hosting events? And then I within the yes people, there were only 7 of 46 that said yes, I had like an informal category and a formal category. So informal being like farm tours, like in general, just like sort of having outside community people on the farm. And then formal being like, yes, I offer a full on, something I call education.
At the farm. Where there's a curriculum and the whole plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So that's a really good question for sure. Yeah.
It's great that you got to 46. It's a lot.
Yeah. It was good. It was fun to interview people. And it was so meaningful for me because that was in, it's right where I'm from. And it was, for me, a really nice way to engage with the food system I grew up with that I definitely have not had that relationship with. I mean, I left the Bay Area when I was 18 and went off to college and really haven't looked back very hard at it since then. I've kind of treated it as a bit of a, like, it's where my parents are and I visit and I think it's crowded and gentrified. So it was really, really nice for me, to reconnect with it in this way. So really early on in the project, maybe serendipity, you could call it, found the Farm-Based Education Network, which I certainly had not heard of before. It's an online network that consists of something like more than 3,000 members. It's based in Vermont, but it's online. So farmers and educators from all around the US and the world And so, for example, they just call farm-based education, basically just any farming space that provides access and experiences at a working farm. So obviously that's like incredibly, you know, broad. And I really left it like pretty darn broad with who I interviewed. So because I wanted to have like a diverse range of how much, for example, people were weighing production, like farming production versus pedagogy. So I ended up interviewing, programs that were really like school education first, like actual schools, like Waldorf style schools, for example, where the farm is sort of the, you know, a platform, but really education is coming kind of first and is most central. And then I also interviewed full production ranches, for example, where they offered education opportunities like internships, 4-H kind of internships, maybe had some summer camps, had field trips come out there, but really like they're a, you know, production operation, making their money from farming. So I basically, the definition of farm-based education for the sake of my research is really, if you are a farm or even a garden space offering for people to come to your place and learn there in some form or another. So very broad.
Makes sense to keep it broad.
Yeah. And I was asked, for example, like the community I'm living at here in France while I do this research and finish up this project. So they're an eco village. So they have like permaculture gardens, and then they also host education camps that are like English immersion / nature kinds of camps, where they use the gardens pedagogically for the camps, but not like, they certainly aren't marketing it as like a garden or farm kind of camp. And then they also host a number of there's always people here coming in and out of workshops, whether it's an actual like permaculture or agroecology workshop, or simply like a, you know, yoga workshop for the weekend. So I actually, when I I've been working with them throughout this project, like discussing the materials with them, talking about how, what this all looks like in France as well. And when I gave them sort of a presentation on the work I had done so far, analyzing the programs in the US, they literally asked me, so are we farm-based education? Like, it was sort of this kind of, oh, I didn't even really know that that's what we're doing. And I was kind of like, yeah, I mean, you are doing that right now. And one question they asked immediately was like, well, does woofing count? Is that farm-based education? And I thought that was quite an interesting question. And to me, I thought, yes, you know, you have, you're hosting people who are working, and usually, not always, but usually doing it out of some kind of motivation to learn, since it's not a paid exchange, right? It's a work trade. Anyways, that's just a little anecdote to kind of paint the picture of like what really can be considered farm-based education, and at least in my eyes and for this project.
Just like a side note on that, because I've woofed in the past, and I live at an eco village in Western Mass, and we host woofers here, and so it's something that is near and dear to me. I've been finding myself in this conversation a lot of like, are people being taken advantage of when they work for free on farms? And I think if education wasn't a component, like you're saying, like if they didn't have that educational motive, and if it wasn't categorized as farm-based education, then there would be such a stronger argument mm-hmm. of like, yeah, these people are giving their work for free and they're being taken advantage of and they're not being compensated fairly. But if you look at it as they're being compensated with skills and education, then it becomes a lot more mutually mm-hmm. beneficial and equal.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And that's obviously, I mean, you know, that's a whole separate super relevant mm-hmm. and interesting conversation of woofing and if and like power dynamics within woofing and power structures and if there's people
it's a delicate dance
for sure. Mm-hmm. But definitely I mean like having motivations from woofers being clear and then if for you as a host, as a farmer host, if you think that offering education is part of sort of like that trade, then to me, it's quite important that that's both clear to like, you know, the woofer and that you're making it, you know, part of the programming, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. So.
Anyways.
I guess. Is it okay to move on to the next
question
or is there anything else you wanted to, okay.
With that, no. Oh, I was going to say, let's see, like kind of elements of farm-based education we can go over a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because I was just mentioning that it can be extremely broad, but I did want to mention like some, you could almost say like universal elements of it, or at least that I saw across the board of every single farm I was in an education program I was interviewing, where the farm-based education is including, hands-on experiential learning. That's mm-hmm. one. Secondly, place-based learning. So those were two that were, you know, every program was important to them, which if you think about like farm-based education makes complete sense. It's, it's obviously place-based because it's farm-based. So the farm is the place. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't have to be hands-on, but of course it pretty much is, since the point is that is you're educating at that place where these experiences happen. So anyways, so those were elements that were in everything or in all the programs across the sort of diversity of this broad farm-based education thing. And then a third thing that I saw pretty much, or I saw in everyone I interviewed, but I wouldn't say it necessarily is part of sort of by definition what farm-based education is, but is this sense that they're teaching where food comes from. And I put that in quotes because that was like a direct quote I heard from almost everyone I interviewed, that it was important to them to teach where food comes from.
Yeah, that's, I think, a really good point, because such a big part of that farm education, farm-based education, and connecting people to where their food comes from is such a strong part of like why we're bringing this conversation into regenerative agriculture and the regenerative mm-hmm. movement. So could you speak a little bit to how you think this work does influence that, like how it might influence eating behaviors and kind of reinvigorating people's connection to nature and where their food comes from?
Yeah, sure. For sure. Yes. So, I mean, that was this question of like where food comes from, and actually, offering that kind of hands-on experience of a student touching their food, harvesting their food, interacting with their food, and then eating it is obviously really powerful. And that was something that was mentioned a lot across the people I was interviewing as one of their greatest successes, was having the moment of a student, for example, like discovering a vegetable they had never heard of, or you know, like didn't realize that that's what it actually looked like out in a garden, Or for example, I had three different people independently mentioned kale tacos or something like that, where they were making, you know, like using kale leaves and putting little veggies in it.
Oh, like lettuce wrap.
Yeah, like lettuce wrap kind of things.
Okay, nice.
And that those were foods that a lot of the kids didn't think they liked, but now that they're actually sort of handling them in real life, it's something that's exciting and actually tastes good. So yeah, I think that's a huge opportunity with farm-based education is influencing eating behavior and diet change. And then something I want to mention, and that's just with like the simple basic of like seeing your food and interacting with food from where it grows, right? And then something I wanted to mention as well is, which goes into like this, the research question of connecting to sustainable food system transformations, is that some of the places I was interviewing, when they talk about where food comes from, they don't just talk about the sort of broader, where does food come from? And like the underlying social and ethical issues around these crops. And so that would be kind of following the like food system approach of agroecology as well, that we were talking about before, of, you know, for example, like maybe you're growing corn out in the field and we're eating that corn and that's great, but trying to actually incorporate discussions of now, like, you know, what's the historical roots of corn, for example, how has it been used in the US, where we, you know, where you live, where I usually live. And like how has that crop, like, you know, affected food systems? Like how has it actually changed a lot of you know, parts of the world through subsidies, and sort of, you know, trying to actually like expand the conversation out of like, where does food come from, not just in a literal sense of like you put corn in the ground and grow it and eat it, but also like what's actually going on behind that.
And the transformation.
Yeah, sorry, exactly.
Cut you off. I just get excited because I know, like, you know, corn has been through so many modifications to get this like plump, juicy variety, right, that we
exactly
kind of take advantage of now. Yeah,
exactly. And starting to talk about that and like the seeds of it and what, you know, where exactly, like who owns seeds now, who owns corn, you know, genetics, etc. So I think it's definitely, farm-based education can be such an opportunity to both educate, you know, to change diet in the sense of like getting people connected to ingredients and getting them to, yeah, try new things, have appreciation for vegetables in a new way, or animal products, whatever it is. But then also, yeah, like reflect on, well, okay, this is where this one corn piece came from, but where does 99.9% of corn, you know, actually come from and go, it, you know, and get transformed into, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know, of course, a really big part of agroecology is like growing within the harmony of nature, and kind of similar to like agroforestry, where you're like mimicking how food would grow in the wild and in nature. And a big part of that is biodiversity and having that diverse crop. So you don't just have fields and fields of corn, of monoculture. And so has that come up at all? This kind of this connection between diet, like biodiversity in the fields and dietary diversity on our plates. I'm curious.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so I want to point out too that like I was intending to leave, I didn't want to just look at places that are organic or like following regenerative agriculture, sort of attached to any particular movements. I was really leaving it like open in case I even stumbled across like a conventional, you know, corn grower or soy corn farmer who are patient programs. So I was leaving it open and doing my best to try to interview people from across the spectrum. But I just want to point out that every farm I was interviewing had a notably diverse production. So it's pretty logical if you think about a farm offering education programs that they would be maybe a farm that's interested in that maybe is already doing sort of agroecological based farming, like that there are in some way mimicking natural processes, and maybe potentially that's giving them more of a like wanting to share that in an educational way. I can't really say like for sure if that's going on, but so it's not like I interviewed I didn't interview any farmer that was like only doing one production. All very diverse. Yeah. And then in terms of like with connecting that diversity to diets, I interviewed a number of places that where food system transformation and like cuisine is part of the programming. So the kids or students in general, whatever age this was, could have been young adults as well, where they're going from like harvesting to actually then cooking their lunches. And obviously you can imagine the diversity of crops available to cook a delicious meal would be helpful when you're cooking to have a diverse palate to work with versus like, well, we only grow, we only grew potatoes this year. So it looks like lunch.
Great to hear that that was kind of already inevitably happening with the farms that you were focusing on. And how, I guess, taking even like a step back from that, not just diet and health, but like it with overall regenerative agriculture practices, like how do you see the role of farm-based education in advancing more regenerative agriculture practices, mindsets, and all that this touches within food systems and beyond food systems?
Well, that's a big question.
You don't have there's no wrong answer. This is really just kind of like what does that question spark for you, I guess.
Sure.
And it could be a potential role, you know, maybe it's not happening yet, but we could be in the future.
Right. I mean, I think, I guess maybe I can even speak of the role of farm-based education and maybe advancing agroecological ag practices, because that's more my background. Although I did interview a number of places that were like explicitly using regenerative agriculture principles, which are largely very similar to agroecological principles.
I don't know the nuanced differences between the two. I'm sure one fits under the umbrella of the other. I don't even know. Maybe regenerative fits within an agroecology.
Yeah, but I would think so. At this point,
it's just terminology,
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I guess that's like, it's a big question because it's like sort of the whole point of the thesis, right? Is like, is kind of like, unpacking the role of farm-based education as a tool to advance agroecological farming and regenerative farming, and then eventually food system transformation, right? So I think to me, it plays a huge role, not only just in that we're, you know, this is an opportunity to really shift them, you know, educate young people in a meaningful way of like, again, both where food comes from in like the literal sense, but also in the more like politicized and zoomed out perspective sense. So it's an opportunity to do that.
Awareness.
Yeah, exactly. To do awareness, but then also like within the backdrop of a very effective sort of education model where you're, where you're offering hands-on experiential learning in a place like these things that have been demonstrated to be quite effective, like pedagogical tools. To me, it's like a, and that's really why I'm like doing the thesis and doing the work, is that I believe in like the role of farm-based education in transforming food systems.
Yeah. And I'm sure it has such a strong potential. Maybe, I don't know if you think about comparing like the US context with France. Uh-huh. From what I understand, French culture, they probably already have that sense of understanding of, you know, respecting where food comes from, not 100%, but if you're just looking at kind of the average mainstream culture, it's going to be, awareness will be stronger in France compared to the US. Mm-hmm. Of course, that is a stereotype, but just to remind you of what US supermarkets look like here and how much is packaged and very far removed from the farms that they were grown on.
Right.
How easy it is for people to live lives here that are disconnected from the food sources. And and so, yeah, I guess I'm curious to make that division between like people that are already living kind of in close connection, like if they're people that live in the neighborhood of the farm and they get to come over and have that education, like that's great. But, you know, how about the people that live in the cities or don't see a farm on their regular day to day, and then they get to spend even one day or, you know, one week at a farm? That could probably make such a big impact.
Yeah, definitely. And that was something that came up a lot, like when looking at, you know, if you remember the bubbles of agroecology, food justice and sovereignty and popular education.
Yeah.
Again and again, I kind of like a sub theme of the food justice and food sovereignty bubble that kept emerging was increasing access to the space. So like removing barriers and obstacles for people to get there who wouldn't normally be able to access an outdoor farm space like this. Both removing obstacles and like encouraging. That came up a lot for sure. Right. And I think is like, this sort of the whole culmination of the thesis is like sort of a list of like actual actions you can take to connect more to food system transformations. So that was kind of I've got my table with like all the ways I saw people increasing access in one way or another to their farming.
Okay. Yeah, that's exciting. And that brings up a few questions based off of what you just said. So like that list of recommendations or action items, is that geared for all different audiences or is it specific for the audience of farms?
I would say it's geared towards any farm-based education program. And again, like farm-based education being that pretty broad term I was discussing, like whether you're a literal like farm camp or whether you're hosting woofers or just have like an internship program or something like that.
Yeah, and I imagine at that level it could even be a homestead that wants to bring on volunteers or do for any kind of community program there.
Absolutely.
I'm curious to get a little like sneak peek of that, you know, reflecting on all the different projects and initiatives that you've been engaging with, what are those bright spots that come to mind, either projects as a whole or like certain aspects within them? Like, what do you feel should be elevated and shared and scaled?
So I didn't cover like, after discussing like the more abstract concepts of analysis, like agroecology, food justice, and food sovereignty, popular education. I also like took from a theory called transformative agroecology education theory by Colin Anderson, a guy over at But anyways, that was really looking at like actual, what's it called? Like, yeah, like qualities across organizations, like qualities across agroecology education organizations who are really tied explicitly to food sovereignty. So basically like these groups that are really tied into food system transformation, this author was looking at, okay, what do we see across the board from these programs? So trying to get a sense of actual like actions that then other programs can implement. Mm-hmm. So that author came up with like four key qualities that I then was also looking at. So, and I find them really helpful, or I found them really helpful for like the analysis of the whole thing, because they're a lot more tangible than just like agroecology for justice. But yeah, so before there's horizontalism, which is trying to implement democratic communications within your education system, which are actively trying to be non-hierarchical and anti-authoritarian. So that's kind of, removing like pretty typical power structures of like teacher student, trying to encourage student responsibility, or like provide opportunities for student responsibility and decision making within the education program you're offering. So that was one. And then let's see, I can even kind of give some examples.
Yeah, it's cool that you could see kind of the academic side. Like you said, this came from an article,
mm-hmm.
but apply the qualities that they're sharing in the actual projects that you got to know.
Exactly. And that was sort of, that was the point of like trying to look at these theories and see what's actually happening in real life, to kind of build up a list of like, okay, how are people doing this work? What does it look like when it's being done in real life, to make it something that a farm-based educator can look at and be like, oh, I could do that. Mm-hmm. That program's doing that, I could do that.
Yeah.
So for example, with horizontalism, let's see, let me pull up like a few real life examples of that in action.
It's funny that when I hear that word, I don't know, the first thing that comes to mind is like somebody that refuses to be vertical, that like only wants to be horizontal.
Right. Like, that's so funny. Laying down like, education.
We don't horizontalist.
Oh, that's super funny.
The real meaning is good too.
Right. Okay. So for example, with horizontalism, there was a farm I talked to where they have youth interns who are paid during the summer, like high school students, to work at the farm and sell the farm produce and distribute the farm produce for free as well. So this was a nonprofit working farm. Mm-hmm. But because they're a nonprofit, they were actually donating a lot of the food they grow. So they had their, I called this like giving responsibility and agency to youth. They had their youth interns like really running the show. That was a quote. They run the show at our weekly farmers markets. So the interns themselves were in charge of like everything from harvesting, washing, setting up the stands, even selling, like actually engaging with the customers, chatting with them, handling all the money, completely running the market operations. So to me, that's an example of horizontalism in action, where it's like, this is completely, that is a like horizontal power dynamic where the youth interns have just as much power within this as, for example, like the teacher. Like the youth interns are the ones doing everything, and have that like ownership and responsibility. So that's just one example. Yeah. Okay, so then the next one within these, like, and then just to connect it back to like that, for example, horizontalism, you could really see within the umbrella of popular education, of like that more. Nice. So that's kind of almost like a how-to of the more abstract concept of popular education.
That's great.
And let me know if any of this just, yeah, if it's not making sense. It's really like,
no, I think it's great. I think,
okay, cool.
It's tying, yeah, applicable examples to kind of the broader concepts.
Cool.
I'm curious if the wisdom dialogue, and not that you have to like add this if it doesn't already include it, but I'm just curious if there's any component of like indigenous practices, if that's something that I'm sure could like naturally come up. Is,
yeah, is it for sure. Anything? Yeah, that came up in a lot of programs for sure. Mm-hmm. So I would categorize that in, depending on how it was sort of framed, it would either go into like actually relationship to land, where people were honoring like the indigenous ancestral, you know, ownership of land, or relationship to land maybe is a better way to put it. I would also sometimes put it within food justice and sovereignty, especially if they're talking about like that land history from a lens of a justice lens of like where rights and wrongs were potentially made due to like racial, structures of, exactly, of like indigenous versus, colonist, dynamics. And then if it was actually like a present day relationship with indigenous folks, so potentially there are actually still indigenous tribes in this area that the farm was at, and they have a partnership with that, which I saw from a number of places, then I actually put that into building social movements, which I'm gonna talk about that specific one in a second.
Because you started to talk with the four key qualities.
So right, let's get through those.
Yeah.
Let's get through those and I'll make it a bit more, I can just do like the last three and then an example for each one. So it's a little more.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we just covered horizontalism.
Yeah.
The next one is called wisdom dialogues. So this is referring to intergenerational and interplace dialogues between food producers, food system actors, students, and formal and informal education and research institutions. So this is one of my favorite categories because in some ways it's almost like the most no-brainer to include, but like is often overlooked when people design education programs. Yeah. And I'll just give a quick example of wisdom dialogues in action. And again, wisdom dialogues would be like within the broader concept of like abstract concept of popular education. So yeah, super simple example. One of the farms I interviewed, they have their youth visiting and working with other community food system organizations, where they have students interviewing school staff, parents, local farmers, community members about food systems related issues, and then trying to like tie that back into their own farm. So that's an example, like a really easy example of wisdom, or I don't want to say easy, but that's an example of wisdom dialogues in action. That, and it's a quite, you know, it's not like this is a costly thing for an education program to implement. Okay.
And then I also want to point, I said I would only give one example, but I am going to point out That's just fine. One other example where programs might have like more, be more directed at older students or young adults even, and then have those young adults or older youth students be mentors for younger kids in the program. So this one farm, for example, has a garden buddy system that they call it, where like each older kid is paired with a younger kid in the garden that they work with throughout the whole school year. And that's a program that's a continuous program throughout the school year, of course. But that could work as well for even just like a summer camp program where it's not necessarily like long-term. Okay, so that's wisdom dialogues. Next is building social movements. So this is connecting with nested local organizations to create collective action at community and beyond skills. This is again something that almost like seem, I don't know, it's like it's almost seems obvious when you think about it. Like, of course, programs would be more connected to system transformations if they work with other organizations that are also working towards food system transformation. But it's like not necessarily something you would think about when you're designing a farm-based education program. So, but I saw some really like rich examples of this. I'm going to give one example here. This is really related to your question. This was a farm that partners with the local native tribe in their area, where the tribe hosts educational native programming at the farm. Like, so they're able to use that farm space and assist the farm in researching and educating public about land history, land acknowledgements, and reparations. So in that way, it's important with this particular like action of partnering with other community organizations. And I started calling it partnering with other mission aligned community organizations, but it's important too that this is like a symbiotic, mutually beneficial, you know, relationship where, both organizations are getting something out of it. So for in this example with the partnership with the local native tribe, the tribe is getting paid and is getting land access and is getting to educate about their own history. And then in the farm as is getting then to have programming cultural programming at their farm that might interest the public and bring more people to the farm, etc. So it's something that's working for both of those partners.
Yeah, that's awesome. And this is potential for me to get on such a tangent about this, so I'll try to keep it short, but it's just exciting to hear because when it's like when the mission is the center of what everybody's aligning on, there's so much room for collaboration and shared resources, everybody kind of contributing their own piece of the puzzle. And as opposed to like if it's a commercial venture and we are everybody's just in it for money, then there's it just doesn't flow the same way. Like
exactly
rallying around a mission, it seems like it's natural, like, oh, okay, well, I get this and I'm going to give you this and you're going to get this from me. And, you know, it's not always perfect, of course, but.
Totally. And that was something too, I started calling it, I used that mission aligned terminology from one of the farms I interviewed, who is a farm that's like in their mission statement is that they're working towards food justice and food sovereignty explicitly. And they were talking about that they started to really make it like, obligatory for organizations they're working with to also share that mission.
Bringing in Indigenous knowledge is seriously just like you said before, a no-brainer. They've thousands of years been practicing how to live more in harmony with nature and in all of our processes. So it's really great when their voices get to be raised this way.
Yeah, for sure. There was a nice other example as well of a different farm that had a nice, had like a quite, you know, we can call it symbiotic relationship with the native tribe in their area, where they were having the farm youth interns would actually just go to that tribe's land space and volunteer for them like once a week of their like 5 working days. So you could almost look at that as sort of like an act of reparations, first off, of like, you know, through labor. You can also look at it as an opportunity of wisdom dialogues for the students, of getting to, you know, share discussion spaces with then the native tribe, who in many ways is like, you know, yet another food system actor with a different perspective. So anyways, that's, yeah, that's just an example where it's like, yay, good.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're just on the fourth.
Okay. Yeah. Fourth one. Okay. So the fourth one is combining the practical and the political. And so, yeah, this starts from youth education, where linking, and this is a quote now, linking localized learning activities to global discourses of food sovereignty and agroecology helps productively politicize education programs.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so very nice. So you can kind of think of it as like both, like explicitly politicizing your education, and then also like combining practical skill building of like teaching skills that are useful for politicizing things. And I can give an example. There's one of where the students are practicing their like community organizing skills, where the interns at this particular farm put on events for the community, and they're in charge of, like, for example, the publicity, the running the event. Like, it's again kind of ties into the horizontalism thing as well, where they're like running the show of the whole event. But then trying to, yeah, then tie that in with the students of like, this is a skill that, you know, of community organizing that is helpful for, you know, for building up social movements as well, like if you're trying to organize a rally or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's a good it's a good example and a good point. Yeah, that kind like, of makes it it gives it like more the holistic approach of like the programming side of, you know, working at the community level, but community programs can only go so far, or, you know, raising food access can only go so far if there's policies or legislature that's being a barrier. So to introduce that skill as well is huge.
Right.
So we'll definitely look forward to when, you know, the thesis is actually published, and I'm sure that's going to be a really exciting time for you. You're in the home stretch, you're almost there, but we'll be able to share with everybody on the actual paper and then the key messages and advice for farms, organizations, homesteads that are engaged or looking to engage in educational programs that can actually learn from this research. So looking a little bit beyond your thesis project, like how do you envision your role with other people or organizations in the field of regenerative agriculture, in this, you know, in agroecology? Like, I guess I'm kind of asking like what your dream job might look like, but it doesn't have to be a job title in a traditional sense, but like more of just your role within the whole movement.
Sure. Nice, lovely. Thank you. It's a nice opportunity to talk about myself. yeah, well, for me, sort of a what's next is that I'm, I want to put this stuff into action and try to actually do it, basically. I'm not a
yeah, like I was an outdoor educator for 5 years, and I probably didn't open my laptop more than, you know, 10 times in that period of time. And so for me, I really look forward to actually getting back to like reality, basically, and doing things. And right now I'm actually at this eco village in France. I've just sort of petitioned to stay here for another year, and basically try to connect their already existing eco camp program to more to their farming program. So since I've been living here in March, I've been really like quite nearly full time running their gardens and farms and their woofer program as a bit of an exchange for living here. And yeah, because I come from a farming background, it was like a nice thing I could offer to them. And then I've also been working for their eco camps and like teaching English a bit at the local schools. So I'm really trying to see what I can do in terms of like connecting their camps to the garden space more. And then beyond that, trying to, you know, like longer zoomed out from a year, is trying to see if I can actually implement these, you know, elements I've been talking about of like food system transformation within a program I could potentially build here. So I'm thinking a lot about how I can, like we were discussing, increase the access to this space to people who don't normally have access to that. So I'm in a location right now that's within about a 2-hour distance of the metropolitan areas of Lyon and Marseille, which both have really high immigrant and refugee populations. So I'm thinking about now how to potentially get, grant funding to have education programs that are accessible for free to those folks. I mean, I have like quite specific dreams of building. Like I said, I was leading the trail crews that were like 5 to 6 weeks long, immersive, like service-based learning opportunities for kids. Those were all free for the kids too. And I actually led some where it was a job for the kids, like the grant funding was such that they were getting paid for them, which was really amazing. So I would love to try to set something like that up basically here in France, but on the farm, where they're learning, where they're staying for 5-6 weeks, learning not just like farm skills, but entire like sort of food system skills. And then where that access piece is there as well, where it's like something that's actually, free or paid, service-based learning for the kids. Mm-hmm. And the kids are coming from, not just necessarily like the farm next door to this farm, but are coming from places where they're not necessarily having those opportunities to get skills within farming and food systems, etc. So that's kind of that's my dream. And I'm like awesome. Really, really fortunate and privileged to have found this little eco village here where it seems like it might actually be a platform where that's possible. So mm-hmm. we'll see what happens.
That's great. Sounds like you've, even at sometimes it might seem unintentionally carved the path that really makes sense for you and your role in this movement. So
right.
It's exciting. I'm excited to see where it goes. Yeah. So I'm probably put like the name of the where you're living and working now in France. Like people might be interested in checking out if they have a website or just learning more, mm-hmm. put that in the notes and anything else you want. There might be some supplementary things for people to read connected to your research and mm-hmm. what you've been up to. So we'll add that all to the show notes.
Cool.
Any final words for us?
I'm glad we're all out there doing, work on whatever it, whatever you're doing, that you're working like with real dirt in your hands and real, having mm-hmm. a direct relationship to land. I think that's like really beautiful. And then I guess I just encourage all of us, including myself, to like continuously critically reflect on our role within like the sort of bigger issues. Remember that it's like not you know, I don't know, there's the dirt under your hands, but that's connected to the dirt under everyone's hands. And we don't all get to play with that dirt equally. So trying to think of the ways you can be part of, grounded in your own reality, but also part of like, you know, the bigger picture. And yeah,
that is a beautiful thing to close with, that we are all connected in so many ways. So yeah, just grateful for Regain, kind of being the impetus to getting us to chat together. And hopefully we can continue connecting there. You know, for when this is posted there, people have some things that have come up for them in listening to this and get some discussions going on there. So I guess that's it.
Cool. Well, thank you. Thanks, Michelle. Super nice talking to you.